Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the deep well of hatred towards Hillary Clinton that Donald Trump and his closest advisors, David Bossi, Steve Bannon and Roger Ailes, are tapping into, bringing the usually hidden sleazy side of politics, opposition research, from the back room to the front as the centerpiece of the Trump campaign. Jennifer Machia, a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M, where she teaches courses on political communications and presidential rhetoric, joins us to discuss why the first woman running for president is being attacked for being a woman and the intensity of the hatred that spews forth at Trump rallies, where his followers shout, "Lock her up," and T-shirts are sold saying, "Trump that bitch," and social media hashtags of "Killery" proliferate. Then, with Hillary Clinton heckled at rallies yesterday and President Obama interrupted at a rally in North Carolina by followers of the right-wing talk show host Alex Jones, who on Friday offered $1,000 to supporters who show up on TV wearing a Bill Clinton rape T-shirt and $5,000 to anyone heard shouting, "Bill Clinton is a rapist," we will focus on the organizer of this onslaught of hate speech and his connection to the Trump campaign. An expert on cults and conspiracy theorists, Arthur Goldwag, the author of The New Hate, A History of Fear and Loathing on the Populist Right, joins us to discuss how the cottage industry of Obama haters suffering from Obama derangement syndrome are migrating to Hillary Clinton, who Alex Jones claims is a demon who smells of sulfur. Then finally, we will speak with a veteran CIA analyst of the Soviet Union and Russia to assess the ramifications of the tailspin that U.S.-Russia relations are in and whether they can be brought back from the brink before an incident in Syria or Ukraine could spark a military confrontation. Melvin Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University, who is the author of National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, and the forthcoming book Whistleblower at the CIA, The Path to Dissent, joins us to discuss how Obama is reckless in his disregard for Russia, while Putin is more and more isolated from professional advice as he surrounds himself with sycophants and yes-men. And joining us now, Jennifer Machia, who's a professor in the Department of Communication at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric. An historian of American political discourse, especially discourse about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency, she's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Machia.
Thank you for having me on your show.
And it does seem that we're in for a pretty rough ride for the rest of this election season, where you've got this peculiar situation where, in effect, the Republican Party is depending upon Vladimir Putin and Julian Assange to get their candidate elected by leaking scandal on Hillary Clinton from hacked emails by Russian intelligence. And on the other side, you've got Donald Trump basically turning to the dark side, where his closest advisors, David Bossi, Steve Bannon and Roger Ailes, seem to be drawing him into a more poisonous rhetoric. So is there a bottom to this, Jennifer?
I do wonder if at some point the American electorate will just turn it off, you know, just turn off all the screens and stop reading the news and just throw up their hands and walk away. We might be getting to that point. I don't know. At this point, it seems like we're still interested. I think the ratings for the second presidential debate were very high. We'll see what happens with the third.
Well, but meanwhile, at the rallies, particularly at the Trump rallies, and by the way, I think it's an important caveat to point out that on both sides, people vilify and objectify the candidates, and particularly their appearance. But even conservatives, for example, call the conservative talk show host in Wisconsin refers to Donald Trump as the Orange Duce, much as fun is made of his hairstyle, etc. But it does seem, though, the level of poisonous rhetoric that's leveled against Hillary Clinton is in a category of its own. At these rallies lately, we know that Alex Jones is putting up money for people that would wear T-shirts saying Bill Clinton, rapist, etc. But at these rallies, they also have T-shirts, Trump that bitch, and they have hashtags on social media, Killary, etc. So as an historian, has it ever been this ugly?
Well, it's ugly this time, and it's ugly in a unique way because of Hillary Clinton being a woman. But, for example, if you compare this election to the election of 1828, which was the grudge match election between Andrew Jackson and John Quincy Adams, you would have found 4 years between 1824 and 1828 of really just vile, terrible things being said about both candidates on both sides. So it's as bad as that, I think, this time. One of the things that was said in 1828 was that Andrew Jackson's mother was actually a prostitute, and in fact, she intermarried with African American, and they didn't use that word, and that her children were sold into slavery, right? So, like, things that were reported at that time were just as bad, I think, as things that are reported now. But now we have social media, and now we have just 1,000 different ways of reiterating those terrible, nasty things. So it's bad this time, but it's as bad as it's ever been.
But we've never had a woman running for president before.
No, we've never had a woman.
And that seems to be different because, for example, the latest ads I've seen from the Trump campaign indicate that the mere fact that Hillary Clinton's a woman makes her weak. They show her stumbling, et cetera, in various footages that they've captured when she's had, you know, after she had that concussion, et cetera, and the 9/11 lapse that she had. So that seems to be a factor in as much as nobody attacks Donald Trump for being a man.
Yeah, that's right. And so, for example, again, in 1828, you did have attacks against Andrew Jackson's mother and his wife and things like that. So you do have women being attacked, you know, but it's a way of attacking the man, right, to attack the mother or the wife. In this instance, we're clearly attacking Hillary Clinton for being a woman, and it does seem irrational. For folks who aren't used to the attacks that are made on a regular basis against her in the more right-wing, non-traditional media, I think a lot of what Donald Trump accused her of on Sunday seemed like conspiracy theory. It seemed ludicrous and irrational. And so I think that what we're seeing is that she's a woman, but also that there's a different truth reality, a different discourse community that has for 10, 20, I don't know how long, how many years, cultivated a real opposition to her and developed, you know, sort of layer upon layer of truths or mistruths about her, and that they all get invoked and unleashed all at one time. And it's very overwhelming if you're not familiar with those things.
Well, it's got to be overwhelming for her, though. I mean, when Trump yeah. said that she has hatred in her heart right to her face and said she should, the first thing you do is put her in jail. Particularly when he said you have hatred in your heart, I saw her flinch like she couldn't believe he was saying that.
She did, and then she looked at her family.
Right.
Sort of made a look.
Well, you know, I happen to know somebody who wrote a book with Bill Clinton and spent a lot of time there with him in their place in New York. He was telling me that being around them was just wonderful. They were just the most warm, loving couple that he spent time with. So I'm sure there's a whole other side of this story that you just don't hear.
Yeah.
But the other one, that this satanic version of her, that, as you say, has taken decades for the right to build, is pretty much fixated in so many people's minds. I don't know what she can do. It must be very hurtful for her to try and figure out why they hate her.
I think that has to be right. I've never met either of the Clintons, but it's interesting to hear that your friend who knows them well says that, because that's, you know, the opposite of what people who have written books with Donald Trump say about him. It's interesting to me to think about this. I live in a conservative area of Texas, And the vehemence towards her, the hatred towards her, is startling. People are not pro-Trump here, but they are very much anti-Hillary Clinton. And they really think that the nation will be destroyed if this terrible woman occupies the White House. I have to think that part of the animus towards her is a kind of misogyny that is really, I think, evidence of the nation struggling to understand how to come to terms with a woman in power. I don't think that we really came to terms with that in the 90s when we first had her in the public sphere, and instead we sort of demonized her. And it's interesting to me to think about it because, you know, in the early American period, the founders believed that ambition was the thing that disqualified you for office, right? To be ambitious meant that you were self-serving, self-interested, that you were the worst kind of, you know, person. You weren't a statesman. To be a statesman or to be famous in the early republic meant that you were thinking of the common good and the public and trying to leave a lasting impact of liberty, right? And so ambition was the opposite of that. And I think that we have come to believe that ambition is good for men. And so when we see a man who's seeking public office, and that's clearly an ambition, it's ambitious to do that, we applaud that. But I don't think that we know how to understand women as ambitious. And so the words that we use to describe ambitious women happen to be demeaning. You know, we call them bitch, we call them aggressive, we call them bossy. Those are all words that indicate that we are uncomfortable with an ambitious woman. And so it's interesting to me to see that we still haven't come to terms with women being ambitious where we have with men, but also that perhaps seeing a woman in the White House might alter that. Perhaps this year we might be able to start to deal with the fact that women are also ambitious.
But the odd thing is that Hillary Clinton also gets attacked from the left. There's an article at the BBC that I'm just going to read from here. During the Bernie Sanders campaign, Andrew Levine, a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, told the BBC that he would swim through vomit before voting for Hillary Clinton. And I know from some colleagues here at this radio station, women, by the way, who just hate Hillary Clinton with a passion and think she's a warmonger and a blinded to any, and you've got Jill Stein out there making this ridiculous claim that there's no difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. So this is not just a bunch of misogynist men out there that are on the right wing.
Oh, that's right. And I think that part of it could still be this question of we're not used to women being ambitious. I think the left attacking her is a different question, perhaps. You know, they attack her because she is a centrist. I mean, she is someone who might be progressive on social policy, but in terms of foreign policy, military use, economic policy, maybe, right, that she has sided with the center or even the righter part, closer to the middle, I guess, of the Democratic Party. Yeah, I mean, compared to what Bernie Sanders was arguing or what Jill Stein might argue, Hillary Clinton is just as bad as a Republican to them, perhaps.
Well, you wrote an earlier article in the Huffington Post early in the campaign when it's during the primary period when Donald Trump, the reality TV star, was knocking these 16 rivals off the island. And you pointed out early in the game what his MO is in terms of having very, very clever rhetoric, and clearly he won. We know that. Whether he'll win the presidency is another matter. But it does seem that his MO is to sort of float two extraordinary pieces of fiction. One is that the country's in crisis, and the second one being that I'm going to ride in on a white horse and be the nation's hero to rescue us from this demise and make America great again. And he's managed to create his own reality that a lot of people believe in. And as you pointed out earlier, he can just do a blizzard of lies and people just accept them at first glance without, and no matter how many people do fact checks, and Hillary Clinton kept saying, go to my website, this is all nonsense. I don't think too many people went to her website, frankly.
No, I don't think so either. He does seem to be impervious to fact-checking, and I think that that's a function of the different discourse communities and the fact that he's been able to successfully indict the mainstream media with his supporters. His supporters distrust everything they say, including their fact-checks. He's been very successful at that. But to go back to the heroic campaigning, he does do that, obviously, and it's what all politicians do. I mean, that's how you run for office, is that you convince the nation that there's a particular crisis and that you're the one who's best qualified to solve that crisis. I think about this a lot since we wrote the book, and I struggled for a while to name what Hillary Clinton's hero narrative was. I think that she tried to articulate a hero narrative as, you know, sort of attached to second wave feminism, and she was going to break the glass ceiling, and she had been fighting for mothers and families and children and et cetera. But this week, it's very clear that her hero narrative is to save the nation from Donald Trump. The crisis that is facing the nation is Donald Trump, and she's going to save us from Donald Trump. And I think that that might actually work for her.
Well, you know, for the longest time, I've been saying on the air that, you know, I know what Donald Trump stands for. He's going to make America great again and build a wall. But if you ask that same question to Democrats, what does Hillary Clinton stand for? They usually get a silence. Now I think you've filled that silence. That's basically what it is, isn't it? I'm going to save you from Donald Trump,
I'm going to save you from Donald Trump.
Finally, she has a narrative, right?
Well, and it's interesting because it puts her in the position of being the only powerful person who could have been able to save her, save us from him, right? So there were 16 people in the primary. They couldn't save us from Donald Trump. The media has been trying to discredit him for a year. They haven't been able to do that. They weren't more powerful than Donald Trump. The party apparatus was not more powerful than Donald Trump, right? So he has been able to discredit the media, institutions, the process, all of his opponents. He dispatched them easily, in fact, but he cannot, so far at least, he cannot beat Hillary Clinton, and so perhaps she will be able to. I think there was an article this week. She said she was going to save us from the apocalypse, and the apocalypse being the election of the Trump presidency.
Well, didn't you think, Jennifer Machia, that it was an odd end to that debate where they were both asked to say something nice about the other, and Hillary Clinton commended Donald Trump on his children, and then he turned around and said that, you know, what he admired about her was that she was a fighter. And he went on at length to praise her in a way that clearly he meant, and it just suddenly ended. It was like, almost like he was endorsing her, you know. It's like at the end of a commercial, you know, I'm responsible for this message. It was almost like an endorsement. Did you find that extraordinary?
I did find it extraordinary, and as I was watching it, I was imagining the commercial that, as you say, that would run. I think they probably wouldn't want his endorsement, but it did sound like that. And what I think is that it's revealing of him. The thing that he chose to single her out for is strength, the same thing that he chose to single out Putin for, right? He likes strong leaders. He likes to think of himself as strong. And so when he denigrated his opponents before, it was always that they're weak, right? They're low energy. They're weak. They're not strong. And so the fact that he respects her in that way is interesting, but it's also revealing of what he values.
Well, just in the last minute or so then, Jennifer Machia, going back to this hate-filled rhetoric, and it is truly not, you know, one keeps hoping that the better side, the better angels of our nature might emerge here somewhere in this presidential discourse and this political season in general. It's unlikely that will happen. What does it say about America? We know that people are angry. That's obvious. But on the other hand, why are so many people filled with hate?
Yeah, it's a perplexing thing, and I really do hope that we can figure out a way to transcend these differences and move on and sort of re-knit the nation. I'm terrified that this is a situation that's similar to 1860. I hope that that's an exaggeration, but that's how it feels to me right now. So I'm actually writing a book based on that article that you mentioned, where I lay out his different rhetorical strategies. And what I'm arguing in that book is that, you know, there's six or so rhetorical strategies that we can see Donald Trump use throughout his campaign pretty consistently, and that they're useful for him, particularly because right now we live in a polarized, frustrated, distrustful nation. And so the way that he uses rhetoric absolutely appeals specifically to our frustration or to our distrust or to the polarization. And it's divisive, right? And so he has been able to exploit pre-existing things and to exasperate those things. And it's brilliant. It's diabolical, but it's brilliant.
Well, Jennifer Majeer, I thank you very much for joining us.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Majeer, who is a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the author of Founding Fictions and the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into hecklers at Hillary Clinton's and Barack Obama's rallies yesterday, egged on by Alex Jones, who's offering them $5,000 to be heard on TV shouting, Bill Clinton is a rapist. You can save the conversation. Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time. It's easy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Arthur Goldwag, who's an author whose books include Isms and Ologies, Cults, Conspiracy, and Secret Societies. And his latest book is The New Hate, A History of Fear and Loathing on the Populist Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arthur Goldwag.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And, of course, the populist right candidate, Donald Trump, has sort of surrounded himself with this unholy trinity of David Bossi, Steve Bannon, and Roger Ailes, and he's turning to the dark side and basically saying that the shackles are off the Republican Party's influence over him, and he's going to be his own man, which seems to mean that he's just going to get more and more nasty. And the person that's really pushing the envelope in terms of nastiness is this fellow Alex Jones, this conspiracy theorist and right-wing radio host who founded the InfoWars website. He's offering his followers $1,000 if they pictured on television for at least 5 seconds wearing a Bill Clinton rape T-shirt, and $5,000 to anyone who can be heard shouting, Bill Clinton is a rapist, while wearing such a garment. And that, of course, already has happened at a rally yesterday that President Barack Obama had in North Carolina, and Hillary Clinton in separate rallies that she had as well. So what do you make of this?
I saw one of the winners on MSNBC last night. He was quite a guy.
Well, tell me about it.
Well, he actually looked like Alex Jones, and he had the T-shirt on and his arms flung wide, and he was bellowing. And I hope he gets his $5,000.
So what explains this? I mean, there is this condition called the Obama derangement syndrome. but it seems like it's migrated into the Clinton derangement syndrome, or that they've become sort of merged.
Well, you know that I look at I take a long historical perspective on these things, and I'm old enough to have lived through the first Clinton derangement back in the 90s, and you know, which is what produced Bossie, and it's what it wasn't Roger Ailes' first time in the limelight. I mean, he really came up with Richard Nixon in the 60s. But that was what enabled him to grow Fox News to the juggernaut that it became. And Alex Jones, he's a strange guy. He's kind of a product of the John Birch Society. When he's written about his own epiphany that made him who he is, it was when he stumbled on a Robert Welch book and understood everything. His whole world is conspiracy. And when I wrote Cults, Conspiracies, and Secret Societies, one of the things I came to realize was that real conspiracists, for a real conspiracist, evil is not an adjective, it's a noun. And it's Satan. And when you look at the long, long history of conspiracy theory in America, going all the way back to the Know-Nothings in the 1840s, and before that to the Anti-Masons in the 1830s, and at the turn of the 19th century, 1798, when the Illuminati scare happened, when you cut through, there's all kinds of contemporary ideology. It's inflected by all kinds of current events. But what they're really talking about is the triumph of Satan. And Hillary Clinton is, as Bill Clinton was, as Obama has been, is the apotheosis of evil. And so when Alex Jones, in a way, you know, with all of the craziness that Donald Trump has stirred up, it's good for him. It gets him more listeners. It gets him, you know, it raises his ratings, and it gets his juices flowing. And with the possibility, the very strong possibility now of Trump losing, it raises the conspiracy meter even higher. And the likelihood, I mean, they're already telling the story of how the election was stolen from them. And Jones has, you know, he has always, he's gone from political thinking to religious thinking. Back in the 80s, he penetrated the Bohemian Grove, and he watched the mask that they put on, where they put leisure to rest in a big bonfire, and then they put care to rest. And then they have their days of leisure, and there's a big bonfire, and he snuck in and filmed the ceremony, and said this was an ancient Babylonian rite, and it was satanic, and he said it with a completely straight face. He believes that the enemy, whoever it is channeling Satan, and for people. For normal people, for secular people, for worldly people, when you have an opposition that is completely convinced that you're Satan, that raises the stakes for you, too. And Hillary voters may not believe that Alex Jones and Donald Trump are satanic, but they should act as though they are, because these people believe this, and they believe that about us.
Well, of course, Alex Jones, I think he started out, or at least he went off the deep end, over Waco. He was very identified with that cult leader who ended up taking all of those people down in flames.
David Koresh.
Yes. But he also believes that the Sandy Hook shooting is a hoax to have the government confiscate guns, etc. It never really happened. It was a false flag operation, as he says. And, of course, he's behind the kind of video primer for the 9/11 Truthers, a film called Loose Change, which he produced, which is a ridiculous film that, in fact, this network that I'm broadcasting on has plugged rather heavily and created a kind of cult of navel-gazing conspiracy theorists who honestly believe that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, these two geniuses, managed to get a bunch of Arabs to fly into these buildings in order to rescue their presidency. So he's all over the place. Is there a consistency here between the religious side? Because he prays now on his radio show, which is also televised. He prays for Donald Trump's election, even though, as you say, he's got an investment in the idea that the election's going to be stolen.
I don't know if you saw him holding forth about the stench of sulfur that comes off of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and how both of them attract flies, and that they have film on the InfoWars site of flies buzzing around Hillary Clinton. And very early in the Obama presidency, he caught a fly with his fingers on TV. And, you know, what that told me is that he has very quick reflexes. What that told the conspiratorial right, and, you know, not it's a wide spectrum on the right. There's lots of right-wing people that just believe in low taxes and the things that they believe in. But taken to an extreme, and when you get to that extreme, you end up absorbing a lot of people from the far left, too. You go in a circle. They believe that we're living in end times. Whether they're practicing Christians or not, they're consistent in this theology that we're seeing signs and wonders that are portents of the end. And you look at all of these millennial end times conspiracies going back to the time of Jesus, and they have these things in common. The enemy is all powerful. They're divine. It's always, as somebody once said, it's always 5 minutes to midnight. It's always near the end. What is so disturbing right now is that they have a guy who, you know, could be elected president, who probably doesn't believe this stuff, but who knows that it galvanizes and inspires his following, and at this point, this is his base, is the angry, racist, conspiratorial right, and you know, just like I wrote in The New Hate, somebody has pulled every one of these levers and brought himself within reach of the presidency. It's very, very scary.
Well, it turns out that Trump's advisor, Roger Stone, who is the liaison with the WikiLeaks guy, Julian Assange, which the FBI are looking into, because he's dumping all of this stuff that he's getting from Russian intelligence. And Roger Stone's also close to Alex Jones. So there is a connection to the Trump campaign. Trump's been on Alex Jones' show a few times. So he can't completely distance himself from this guy. By the way, the idea that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are demons who smell like sulfur, I think Obama made a joke about that, didn't he, yesterday in the rally?
He did.
What did he do? I didn't see the video. What did he do?
He sniffed himself and said, "I don't smell any sulfur." But he had clearly seen the clip on the internet. I doubt that he studies Alex Jones. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Alex Jones has been a noise in the background for 25 years. But all of a sudden, you know, Rand Paul used to go on his show a lot, too. Rand Paul was Jones's first choice. Mm-hmm. And there's a connection through the John Birch Society, I think, with Ron Paul, going back a long ways. Ron Paul and Lou Rockwell, who was a, he's a, what do they call themselves, an anarcho-capitalist. And again, you get this blending of the far right and the far left, the fringe right and the fringe left in some of these things. But the idea, you know, Alex Jones makes Rush Limbaugh look like George Cannon or something, Walter Lippmann. I mean, he does have a very large audience, too. It's probably not in the millions, but it's very, very significant. And we're going to hear from those people more and more. And what I'm waiting to hear is the grand conspiratorial themes from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is also where a lot of this stuff comes from. And I'm waiting to hear Donald Trump pushing the anti-Semitic buttons. The Nazis and the white supremacists, the real alt-right. There's been this misunderstanding. When Hillary Clinton was talking about the deplorables and the alt-right, she was talking about Nazis and these white supremacist groups. They always used to be way, way off on the fringe, but the Breitbart publications, they actually use some of these people now, and they're creeping closer and closer to the mainstream. And a long time white nationalist like Jared Taylor is I see him on TV all the time now. You know, he's not at the point where they're giving him equal time with other pundits, but he's gotten on the news. And Trump, again, I don't know what Trump's ideology is, but he is using these people and he's pushing these buttons, and it's real. And from all indications, now that Trump is losing the mainstream of the Republican Party, these are the people he's going to use more and more. And we'll be hearing more and more of this crazy stuff.
But you can't help noticing the link between the fact that Donald Trump, just shortly before the last debate, invited the press in to introduce Juanita Broderick and Paula Jones and Kathleen Willey and a woman called Kathy Shelton, who claims that Hillary Clinton somehow was responsible for the fact that she was raped when Hillary Clinton was basically had to take a case as a public defender, which she didn't want to take, of the guy that raped her. And for reasons I don't know the full details, but Bannon arranged Bannon apparently arranged for the women and was going to have them sit right in a position where Bill Clinton would have had to walk by them. But at the last minute, the Republican head of the debate commission, Fahrenthold, managed to stop that. But the point I wanted to make was that it's pretty clear that Trump brought these women out, and it's pretty extraordinary to think they all claim that they've been sexually abused, and yet here they are supporting a guy who is a sexual abuser. So it's just surreal.
It's Trump's whole mode is he projects himself onto his rivals. Well, when he looked at Hillary Clinton, and he called her the devil too during the debate, he really did. He said Bernie Sanders made a deal with the devil, meaning her, just before he said he would throw her in jail. And then he, he also said, "You have a heart full of hate." And as the author of The New Hate, you know, it rang in my ears. But what he was doing was projecting himself onto her. And that, you know, that it works for the Breitbart publications. Hate works. Anger works. They're not as crazy as Alex Jones, but they're kind of merging with him now. And you can't be, you know, you can't be clinical about it because the stakes are really high. Trump could get in, and then these people would be so empowered they wouldn't know what to do with themselves.
Well, just in closing, though, I wanted to make the link, though, that the fact that Trump, Bossie, and Bannon trucked out these women at the debate, and one of whom accuses Bill Clinton of raping her, none of this stuff has ever been proven at all. And he did make a deal with Paula Jones because I think basically it was one of those situations where it was a case of extortion, you know, rather than to have this thing drag out forever. And I recall James Carville said, Paula Jones is what happens when you drag a $100 bill through a trailer park. I mean, she was totally out to extort him, it would seem. Never any proof that he had anything to do with her. But nevertheless, they've blown it up. But the point I wanted to make was that isn't it clear that this Bill Clinton, the rapist T-shirts that Alex Jones is offering $1,000 to his followers or $5,000 if they get on TV to wear, there's a direct connection, isn't it, between what Trump trucked out?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's what Blasey's book was about. And Roger Ailes was all prepared to promote that book on Fox TV. Blasey's a part of the Trump campaign now. Bannon put him up to writing the book. They're all completely connected. And, you know, back 20 years ago or 25 years ago, whatever it was, when Hillary Clinton talked about the vast right-wing conspiracy, she wasn't being paranoid. These people were consciously working together to destroy the Clintons. And, you know, Alex, as whenever you start talking about conspiracy theory, you have to say, you know, there are real conspiracies. But in this case, the conspiracy isn't that Satan is about to take over the government. It's that these horrible right-wing demagogues are getting together and using everything they have in their power to scare people and manipulate them.
Well, Arthur Goldwag, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Arthur Goldwag, who's an author whose books include Isms and Ologies, Cults, Conspiracies, and Secret Societies, and his latest, The New Hate, A History of Fear and Loathing on the Populist Right. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether U.S.-Russian relations can be brought back from the brink. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. And he's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. And his forthcoming book is Whistleblower at the CIA, The Path to Dissent. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melvin Goodman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you again.
And it's extraordinary the extent to which the Republican Party, which has normally been a pretty hawkish party, particularly during the Cold War vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, is essentially relying on Vladimir Putin and Julian Assange to get their guy, Donald Trump, elected. It's gone so far as the Russia's ambassador to the United Nations filing a complaint with the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, about comments by Prince Ziad Rad al-Hussein, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, who denounced Donald Trump's racist rhetorics. And Churkin says that Prince Zayed is overstepping his limits from time to time, and we're very unhappy about this. So here you have the Russians at the UN defending Donald Trump's racist rhetoric and basically trying to get the UN official to stop. So What is this? What is going on? You've spent years and years at the CIA, involved in the Soviet on the Soviet desk, I guess, for the want of a better description, dealing with the Soviet Union. Have you ever seen anything like this?
No, this is unusual, but we do have a situation where Putin would like to see anyone elected president in the United States other than Hillary Clinton. There's no question in my mind that Putin has engaged Hillary Clinton in a very personal way. I think he blames her personally for inciting some of the Russian protests that took place about 5 years ago in Moscow. I think he blames her personally for some of the activity in Ukraine, particularly her Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, Victoria Nuland, who made some very critical remarks about Ukrainian politicians, particularly those linked to Russia. So I think we're not seeing, to me, a special relationship between Putin and Trump so much as a focus by Vladimir Putin on Hillary Clinton. So all of this talk about a money trail between Trump and Moscow, and that there's some Russian connection, or that his former campaign manager, who did have ties to the former Ukrainian president, Yanukovych, who was obviously pro-Moscow. But I think all of these characterizations are much too simplified and go much too far. And really, it's not so much the Republican Party that's using this as a tactic. It's Donald Trump who has picked up a line on Vladimir Putin that he has totally distorted what's going on in Moscow. He even said in the debate on Sunday that I know nothing about Russia, which I think is probably accurate. And he has certainly incorrectly described what Russia is doing in Syria on behalf of Assad. So I think there's a lot of mythology here. I think there's a lot of conspiracy theory here. And the only thing I get out of it is Putin has focused on Hillary and wants to deny her the White House.
So you don't think that rumors about the Russians having a honey trap video, after all, you know, Putin came to power in his first election. He destroyed his opponent by using a honey trap video of this man with a couple of young Russian women. Putin won. And, of course, that was put all over the media. And Putin won, I think, something like 90% to 10% or something in a landslide in his first election. So that's one of the rumors that keeps swirling about to explain why Trump, whenever he's given an opportunity to criticize Putin, he doesn't. In fact, at the debate that you just mentioned on Sunday, he didn't criticize Putin. He mischaracterized what he's doing in Syria and seems to go out of his way to avoid criticizing Putin. Is there a reason that you think that Putin has something over him?
I think it's, at least for me, very difficult to wrap my brain around what it is that Trump is doing and why he's doing it. Clearly, he has focused on Putin as a strong leader. Trump sees himself as a strong leader. He likes the macho instincts in Putin. He sees that in himself. And I think Putin, what's being missed in all of the stories about Russian involvement in the U.S. election is all of the leadership changes that Putin is making in Moscow. What concerns me is not so much a Trump-Putin connection, which I don't think really exists, but you've got a much more powerful Vladimir Putin who's moving out old colleagues who had some background, who has some experience, and he's moved real amateurs, real neophytes into very key positions like chief of staff and the National Guard Force and the Drug Enforcement Agency. He sent out new governors to at least three regions who were former bodyguards to Vladimir Putin. So Putin, to me, is really circling the wagons, getting ready for his own reelection in 2 years, less than 2 years. And he certainly, as I said before, wants to deny an election to Hillary Clinton. I think that is clear.
Well, the extraordinary statement that Putin made at this business forum today, where he said that Russia has, this has nothing to do with Russian interest, referring to the alleged hacking into the U.S. election. But then he went on to say, but what's important, the most important thing is what's inside this hacked information, which is pretty much a contradiction of what he's saying. I mean, this is the part of it that's extraordinary, is that if you look at the record of all of the things that have hurt Hillary Clinton throughout this campaign, they all can be sourced back to Russian hacking, going right back to the existence of the very server, the private server that's caused us so much problem. That was first released by RT in March of 2013 as a public service based upon this Guccifer hack into Sidney Blumenthal's private AOL account, which revealed he's communicating to Hillary Clinton on this server.
Well, that's true, but a lot of the damage in terms of the emails, and I think it was tremendously self-inflicted damage on Hillary Clinton's part that suggests is some weakness in her own executive decision-making, to me goes back to the Benghazi hearings. That's when it was exposed that there were tens of thousands of emails. Some of these emails were destroyed after those hearings, and that, to me, was the major discussion of the email server that was in her house in New York, to me, came out of the Benghazi hearings 2 years ago. So I'm not sure if the Russians deserve credit for manipulating that one, but I do think they are involved in a game in which they're trying to disrupt the American election. I think this is clear, and of course, Trump is defending them from that charge. I find his motivations very difficult to decipher. So we're in a situation where the United States and Russia, two major nuclear powers, are not talking to each other, not even about nuclear weapons. In the debates, Hillary Clinton keeps taking credit for Russia reducing its nuclear weapons in the wake of the New START agreement that was signed in 2010, when the fact of the matter is Russia had gotten its missiles down even before the agreement was signed, and that Clinton's diplomacy, Secretary of State, and the New START agreement had nothing to do with it. Putin is extremely angry about the Magnitsky Act that put special sanctions on certain Russian leaders. He wants the sanctions ended, and he is even now threatening, actually, followed through, suspending the plutonium management and disposal agreement. That was, I think, another signal sent to the United States about whoever is president. Putin is going to be, has very specific demands, and it's going to be a tough negotiator. So I think we're entering a new era for Russian-American relations, regardless of who's in the White House. But as I said before, I don't think he wants Hillary Clinton in that position.
So if this is a situation that's making former Soviet leader, the last leader of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, nervous, saying this is not a good situation, it's dangerous for the U.S. and the Russia not to be talking to each other. It reminds me of what happened back in the early 80s when Ronald Reagan and the Russians weren't talking as these geriatric leaders kept dropping off one by one. And we had the 1983 war scare in November of 1983. It's, you know, there's a record of this, and I spoke the other day with former Secretary of Defense, who's extremely concerned about this. We still have a Cold War nuclear posture with a hair trigger. And Russia has been building up its military, as has China, and yet the U.S. has this attitude that these emerging powers, and particularly Russia, is a sort of regional power, which I think really insulted Putin. So what would your recommendation be? On the one hand, Putin seems to be testing the limits, particularly in Syria. But on the other hand, is he basically saying, I'm going to screw with you guys, you've screwed with us, as long as NATO moves eastward, I'm going to make life miserable for you? What is he saying to us, and what should we do in response?
Well, I think what's missing from the relations, or the lack of relations, is any kind of institutionalized dialogue. And I think President Obama deserves as much responsibility for that as Vladimir Putin does. I think we're in an environment where there is so much for Moscow and Washington to be discussing, and they have shown in recent years, for example, the Iranian nuclear agreement, which found Russia to be a very important partner, that they can discuss areas of mutual interest, and there are so many sensitive areas that they do share, but there is no real dialogue taking place. And we need an institutionalization of that dialogue. You mentioned Reagan and Reagan's first term. We got a much different President Reagan in the second term, and there you have to give tremendous credit, I thought, to former Secretary of State George Shultz and his aide, who was then seconded to the National Security Council and then became the ambassador to Moscow, Jack Matlock, who convinced Reagan of the need for dialogue. And we went into a very active and very successful environment of arms control, including the INF treaty, which wiped out whole classes of missile systems. What the United States has been doing, and again, Barack Obama personally involved in this, is demonizing Vladimir Putin. Demonization is simply not a policy. Even in the case of Syria, where clearly Putin has gone too far, and I think they are guilty of war crimes, there have been bombings not only of hospitals but of relief convoys, but they are signaling that they do want discussions of all parties who are involved in Syria. Putin wants to keep a place in the Middle East. The naval and air facilities in Syria are the only real military facilities they have outside of the Russian territory itself, and they want some recognition as an international power. And I think Obama's gratuitous remarks discussing Russia as a regional power, which I think are accurate, but again, didn't need to be stated in such a confrontational way. Now, I don't see anyone around Obama who can talk to him on that level. I don't think Secretary of State John Kerry has great standing within the White House. The White House has circled the wagons on a variety of national security situations. In the last few months of his administration, Obama certainly doesn't want to get into the Syrian trap, and I think he sees Syria as a trap, and I think he's right about that, that the real problem for Obama is ignoring the humanitarian crisis, which I think is going to be a major part of his legacy and one of the most negative aspects. But I think he could do his successor, whoever it is, a real favor by getting back to some environment of dialogue that includes an institutionalization of the dialogue at various levels, levels of the Secretary of Defense and the Defense Minister in Moscow, Secretary of State and the Foreign Minister in Moscow. And this is what's missing from the relationship.
Well, Melvin Goodman, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. He's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. His forthcoming book is Whistleblower at the CIA, The Path to Dissent. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.